For the past 3 years, the Science of Reading Star Awards have honored educators who are beacons of light, guiding their classrooms, schools, districts, and most importantly, students through transformations with literacy. Now join us as we honor this year's winners at a special celebration event, which will feature celebrity keynoters and past podcast guests. Mitchell Brookins.
2 years ago, one of my students as a school administrator came to me on the playground and he said, "Mr. Brookins, I want to be like the other kids." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Mr. Brookins, I want to learn how to read."
And Malcolm Mitchell.
When I scored a touchdown, they either probably put my name in a newspaper. People probably tell me good job all around town. But when I finished one book, no one ever said anything. So which one am I more likely to repeat?
Find out more information and register for the 2024 Science of Reading Star Awards Ceremony at amplify.com/Star Awards Celebrations. That's amplify.com/Star Awards Celebration. All one word.
How do we help students become confident readers? What meaningful conversations should we have to overcome barriers to equity and inclusivity in the classroom? Welcome to Season 4 of Science of Reading, the podcast. I'm your host, Susan Lambert. This season, we're exploring important topics that impact our students every day: reading acceleration and recovery, inclusivity, and meeting students just where they're at on their reading journey. We've lined up an amazing team of experts who will inspire you as they share their perspectives to find fresh ways to help you support your students. This season, we're also honoring educators who have driven change in their district by successfully implementing the Science of Reading. You'll hear from winners of the Amplify Science of Reading Star Awards as they share their experiences fighting for students when no one else would. The Science of Reading movement continues to grow, and as educators, we will continue to grow with it. It's vital that we focus on research-based practices to deliver classroom instruction that allows students to learn. The more we learn and listen, the more we'll be prepared to lead. Our students are counting on us. In today's episode, we talk with Dr. Tracy Whedon, President and CEO of Niehaus Education Center. Dr. Whedon shares her passion of equal access for all in the teaching of reading, and how important this topic is to both individuals and to our country. For leaders, she provides practical advice for taking on the work of ensuring all students learn to read, which includes strategically employing resources in a multi-year Science of Reading initiative. Well, Dr. Tracy Whedon, it's such a pleasure to have you on today's episode.
I am so honored to join you, Susan. Thank you for having me.
Oh, absolutely. And as you know, we just love for our guests to share a little bit about what brought them into this space of Science of Reading, why you're so passionate about it. It just really helps our listeners understand who you are and where you're coming from. So I'd love for you to tell us a little bit about you.
Absolutely. I do consider myself a literacy ally and a literacy evangelist, if you will. I will go anywhere in the country or in the world that I can to promote literacy as a way of liberating people. And it's my way of paying it forward. It's interesting today that I'm actually recording this from my mom's home. And my mom was one of those kids who was highly mobile, dealt with many barriers to learning, but did not let that stop her from recognizing the form of currency she wanted to be sure to transfer to us was that of literacy. She had her own learning gaps, but she didn't use that as an excuse to keep us from our dreams. She used that as the why to fight and advocate for us so that the seven of us are all avid readers. Didn't even know that she was a struggling reader until we became adults. And, you know, I think about the children out there who, like my mom, and my dad, who received special education services because he had polio, that our family tree was literally transformed through literacy. And so I get to pay that forward and be that literacy advocate for children, whether they are dyslexic or an adult who never received therapy for dyslexia, or we want to focus on getting reading right the very first time to create a literacy safety net for every boy and girl in this country, for every adult, for every individual in this country. That's my calling, and I'm pressing on because it's challenging work, but it's so rewarding.
Yeah, that's amazing that you're sort of looking at literacy and reading, you know, pretty holistically. You know, some people really focus on the early grades and getting it right for the early learners, and other maybe on adult literacy, but it feels sort of like your passion is all encompassing when it comes to providing that.
That is a really wonderful way to put it, Susan. We know that creating foundational literacy skills is absolutely essential because literacy and reading and comprehending text, it's the mother of all content areas. It doesn't stop there. If we are getting our students ready for a knowledge economy, they need to be able to understand the structure of the English language. They need to be able to speak in that language, need to be able to present their ideas and comprehend it. And that needs to be articulated all the way through to when they graduate from high school. Ideally, not just a proficient reader, writer, and speaker, but being able to perform at advanced levels to be competitive, not just nationally, but internationally. And so when we do that, regardless of zip code, well, it has a transformative effect on that child's potential and the way they rear their own children and translate that currency, if you will, to their own children. Yeah. So that there's a generational impact, which is so profoundly powerful.
Mm. Mm. And you've seen that from your own family. So even more powerful for you to sort of be the advocate of moving this forward.
Absolutely.
So I know right now, oh, go ahead.
Well, you know, I was thinking how fortunate it is. You know, I will always be an inner city girl from Detroit. That's where I grew up. And I had two worlds I navigated. There was the dialect that at times I was loved in, you know, sometimes. And then there was the structured English that I was able to navigate as well. And I find that in our work nationally, at times we're in Appalachia, and that currency and that dialect someone is loved in is not necessarily what's in the classroom. Or it may be, I'm an EL learner, as an English language learner, there's a language that I'm loved in. And it doesn't mean that we have to deny that part of ourselves. It means we get to navigate in both of those types of currency in a way that's situationally appropriate. But if I never get the exposure, there will be no composure in structured English. So that's what every child should have, regardless of zip code.
I love how you say the language that children are loved in compared to the language of maybe schooling. I've never heard it put that way before. It's really lovely to honor both things for a child and be able to prepare children in both of those areas.
I think it's so important to be able to bridge from what they bring to the schoolhouse and honor that, and then connect the dots between that and how it allows them to navigate the world that they're loved in, and pointing I should say, shed light on the potential path forward, and that there are no limitations when we have access. You know, thinking about the COVID crucible we've been in, the people who have suffered the most have been the people who do not have access to structured English, the structure of the language, so that they can get on a call like this and express their ideas and have maybe a job where they can do the work that allows them to work virtually. And I think COVID has underscored that divide in a glaring way we cannot ignore. And beyond just good classroom instruction, there are other barriers to learning. You know, there's hunger, mental health issues, just the stressors of living in this society in general. And the way to change the world, and I don't ask children, what do you want to be when you grow up anymore? I ask them, how do you want to change the world? And what do you need to be able to accomplish that goal? And inevitably, literacy has some part in that desire within a child to be a change agent.
Hmm. That's a lovely way to frame that question. What do you want to be when you grow up? Is maybe who knows, you know, I just heard something that, most of the jobs that our preschoolers and kindergartners are going to have when they grow up don't even exist now. So, that's kind of a hard thing to think about, right?
And we're all transforming, you know, who I was at 20 and who I am at almost 60, very different. And you know,
that is so true.
How I use the language to shape things. It's different. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I know right now you have a pretty significant role at an organization called Nye House. And I would love for you to share with our listeners the work that Nye House does, and particularly your role and your work there.
You know, I'm so fortunate, Susan, in that before I became president and CEO of Nye House Education Center, I had a life-changing experience. And it was a visit to a maximum security prison in Livingston, Texas, where is the place they also happen to house death row inmates. And I visited a very dear friend of mine who was working with inmates who wanted to earn a GED. And some of them had a life sentence. But they just wanted to feel like they had accomplished something really important. They dropped out of high school, hadn't finished, and so I'll get the GED. Well, I spent the day with about 60 of these gentlemen in two groups of 30 and interviewed them and just talked to them about their experiences. And it was pretty interesting how things fell out within that group. I would say about a third of them had been in special education their whole life, basically being warehoused in special education classrooms, never really learning to read and to master the structure of the English language. I'd say another third, dyslexic, often identified once they got to prison and never having received therapy. Mm. The common denominator among them was poverty. And the majority of them were people who had navigated that war zone unsuccessfully and made really unfortunate choices. Only one among them said, you know, I'm innocent. I didn't do anything wrong. They admitted that they had made mistakes, but they did not want that to continue with the next generation. And so part of their goal in earning a GED was to show their children, don't take the wrong path. You can do better than I did. And I will never forget at the end of that visit, I told them I wanted to be a person who could advocate for real change and take their stories forward. And they made a circle around me, a group of them, and held hands, and they prayed over me and asked that I be blessed to be that ally for them. And very shortly after that, the door opened for me to come to serve at Nye House Education Center. What I love about our work, Susan, is that we help teachers get first instruction just right so they can be diagnostic and prescriptive as practitioners. Unfortunately, there's a lot that needs to change in university preparation programs, not just for teachers, but for leaders as well, who deserve to know how to scale the work of the mm-hmm. responsibly, because it's the cornerstone of everything that really matters for kids. We also teach teachers how to pull that small group and intervene, again, diagnostically and prescriptively. And those teachers, once they're well-prepared, recognize the red flags for dyslexia. So rather than waiting for a child to drown in a sea of illiteracy and then administer CPR, they can recognize those red flags and we can provide intervention services for that scholar because it has a social emotional dynamic impact on children that can increase likelihood of drug abuse, alcoholism, suicide. I mean, the quality of life and literacy are intrinsically tied to one another. And to be able to, as a nonprofit organization, support sustainable change is just pure joy to me when I see it activated in the way that will make that intergenerational impact I referenced earlier. That's what it's all about.
That is a very powerful story. And that visit with those prisoners must have been like life-changing for you.
It really was. I was with one of my dearest friends who I worked with prior to Nye House, and we sat shoulder to shoulder And, you know, the interesting thing is she's also a literacy ally, someone who really deeply cares about education. And she happens to be white. I happen to be African-American. And the thing I would say that we have in common is that we're moral allies, because this is a moral issue for our country. It's an issue of having the vision and the will to realize that if we get this right, imagine if we happen to become the most literate nation in the country, made that our collective moonshot, what would happen? It would be dramatic differences in terms of workforce readiness. I think in terms of the quality of life in general for every American, our ability to really think critically, reason deeply, and make great decisions about how to make this world better for everybody to coexist within. So finding that common enemy, which I believe is poverty, and pressing against that together is the right thing and the moral thing to do. And educators, you're the tip of the spear. I love to say to teachers, you know, never say I'm just a teacher. You are a VIP. You are so important. And your work is life-changing. And we need to value teachers, those teachers who are in it for the kids and fighting this battle daily. They deserve our very best to support them to be successful in their craft.
Yeah, that's a great message. And a great reminder to teachers of the impact that they have on students, even when they don't realize it. And the potential impact evidence-based practices can actually bring to the classroom as well. I'd love to ask you a little bit more about, you talked about the sort of the similarities of the gentleman that you talked to. The background was like the common denominator was poverty. You just talked a little bit about the common enemy that you have together with this friend of yours is actually poverty. So talk to us a little bit about the link between both poverty and literacy.
You know, I really believe from what I've observed nationally and what I've experienced in terms of real systemic change, that in terms of creating a playing field people can navigate well, we have adult literacy students from 18 to, I think, 87 years old, who are learning to read for the first
time.
And we continue to serve them virtually, making a pivot to how we support our stakeholders. And it's incredible when you see someone who was functionally at a kindergarten or first grade level as a reader be able to go into a community college and access that opportunity, receive job opportunities that now give them a different quality of life and actually affect their own scholar. Many of these individuals are dyslexic. We don't turn anyone away, but they will often have a kid or two who also end up being dyslexic. And so they're equipped effectively to advocate for them. Well, that's a crucial category of about 20% of our population who are being underserved. What I think in terms of poverty is that it affects the mind, the body, and the spirit. And, you know, we hear about the science of reading, and we know the collective body of evidence that we have today indicates that the brain is not wired for reading. It's wired for language, right? I believe our spirits are wired for reading. I believe our spirits are wired for reading because I can think about books I read growing up that changed my desires and my goals for myself, that changed the way I think about myself in the world, that opened up windows and doors, even though I might just be in my little bedroom, you know, all by myself. But words are containers of power. And when people have those words in their hand in the form of a book, or they're speaking those words, they're shaping the future with that currency. And so when we give that and translate that to every individual, it's transformative. And it's interesting to watch now how many businesses are looking for people with the soft and the hard skills, which are often tied to literacy, either the way we speak or the way we read or comprehend. And so our business community have every reason to say, we need to get this right nationally, because it will literally lift everyone when we achieve this goal together. And so what we're working on is creating proof points nationally that show the way for others who are eager to see real change occur in a way that is sustainable, that is not dependent upon who the leader is, who's superintendent in the district. And that means really deep systems change and building capacity, a network of literacy leaders within every organization, whether it's a state department or it's a district or it's a school.
It's quite a system to have to tackle and change. It's real. If you think about advocacy work, that is real advocacy work. What does that look like on a day-to-day basis for you?
Well, one of the things is because we are a nonprofit, we are not lobbying, but we can most certainly, for state leaders who are really serious about this work, serve as thought partners and shoulder partners about what we've learned that works and we've learned that doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the third grade gates or guarantees, they call it different things in different states. It's not grounded in evidence-based practices as successful. It actually perpetuates the problem, because if we're retaining children and we're saying the same thing over again and even louder, it doesn't change student outcomes. So we can advise on things like that. We can advise on ensuring that when we come up with policies, we're also funding those policies. Because unfunded mandates just means more pressure on districts to do work that they haven't been prepared to do and don't have the funding to do. So the ESSER funding is really important right now. This is a moment where we can seize it and really do some thoughtful work that's built into sustaining evidence-aligned practices. Otherwise, we're just throwing money at the problem the same old way we always have. And what I love to do with district leaders and state department leaders is to unpack how they're leveraging the three variables they can control. How are you using time, investing time in your system to change the trajectory of what's happening academically for children? How are you investing the funding that you're using, and what's the return on investment? And how are you investing in your talent? And are you setting it up where you have coaching and support for leaders and teachers so that they understand the nature of the work? Because there's a ton of work going on out there, but the question is it the right work? If it's not the right work, we just build the snowball of initiative overload. And what happens is there are a few people who are such believers, they're going to just press through. They're going to keep trying. They're going to keep doing the best they can. The tweeners are in a fatigue state, and they're trying to see, is this going to work and should I jump on board? And then there are people who are just checked out, and they're kind of in their comfort zone, and they're not going to change. And they demand a lot of attention from leaders, which keeps them from the right work as well. So really investing in those believers and pushing those people in the middle into that critical mass of those who know how to do the work, it is what moves the needle in the districts we're working with.
You know, as you're talking about moving the needle and, sort of thinking about the systems approach to that, do you have any examples of places that have actually accomplished that? I think some people can be, well, at an individual classroom level, maybe we can make a difference. But at a district level, I mean, we've seen it's really hard to move that needle and to make changes. What kind of success stories have you had from that?
You know, great question. I'll highlight three systems. The first one is rural East Texas, little bitty district, great superintendent who retired a few years ago. But we focused on really strong first instruction in her district and intervention services. She had been investing in intervention services. So by shifting her perspective on preventing reading failure, by investing in those teachers in the early grades and in leaders who knew the work, she ended up recapturing funding that she had been losing. Because when children drop out of school, the title funds go right out of the door with them. So if you look at the cumulative funding loss that districts are experiencing, you would be shocked by the millions and millions of dollars that are just flowing right out of the door. What she also found was that the children were actually retaining what they had gained. And so she was able to recapture that funding to focus on enrichment services for children instead of intervention services.
Wow.
And their data is double.
That's amazing.
Consistently. Another one I will focus on is they actually had in this district coaches, a cadre of coaches, and they recognized that they wanted to invest in their knowledge because they would be that literacy backbone to hold up the initiatives that we were going to roll out. The superintendent was savvy enough to solve the problem first. And so he sat down with his team and his cabinet members and said, this is our data. And it shows that only 63% of our kids are kinder ready when they've been on our pre-K program. So what are we going to do differently? Brought us to the table as a shoulder partner. We talked through systems change that they could consider. Then he put together a cross-purpose design team. One of the problems I see, Susan, is people operating in silos. Special ed's over here, curriculum's over there, EL's over there, and they're not talking to each other. And we all think our work is the most important. And then the poor principal has all of this avalanche of initiative overload rolling down the hill on them and then on the teachers. So by having a cross-purpose team plan the work and then work the plan, there was organizational coherence when we launched the work. And we started with the coaches so that they understood the work, the principals, and then with a gradual release, the teachers. And that way, everybody was, you know, coordinated, synchronized, and moving the needle. And actually, within 2 years, they went from that 64% to 95% kinder ready. And this is in the Valley.
Wow.
Where almost 100% of their students are EL learners. So if we can do that in the Valley, we can do that anywhere. The last one I would recognize is, you know, we have a lot of discussion about equity-based issues. This is a team in Akron Public School. Akron Public School District had the lowest performing elementary school that had been struggling for 10 years to turn the corner on literacy issues. And I think the eighth lowest performing in the state. Wonderful principal who just needed to know what's the right work to do. So they actually flew in to visit one of our lighthouse campuses, I call it. And some of the teachers came out, the superintendent, and they said, we've got to do this. Well, within 1 year, with focused professional learning and coaching, that school went from the bottom tier of schools to the top tier of schools in the district. Yes, by doing the right work. And also they focused on not only first instruction, but the intervention services. And this is a school that is almost 100% African-American and free and reduced lunch. So whether it's Appalachia, whether it's the Valley, whether it's, you know, a majority African-American school, the double-digit growth is consistent across those systems. So that tells me not only do we have evidence-aligned practices we can really lean into and own, but that there are next practices that we need to be thinking about and learning from these systems.
So I want to go back to something that you said about evidence-based practices being an issue of equity.
Yes.
And I think in the science of reading community, there might be confusion about what that means. If I said that to you, science of reading or evidence-based practices are really a matter of equity, how would you respond to that?
I would say 100% I am in agreement with that. And I do think we need to be clear on the language. When we teach the structure of the English language explicitly, we've got to think about the children who came to school with a different form of currency. It's very valuable, a dialect, a language, but is it the dialect and the language of the schoolhouse? And if not, are they behind before they even begin? Will they ever catch up if we don't give them that opportunity? And will understanding the structure of the English language harm any child? Absolutely not. If a child is dyslexic and they receive those practices early on, because dyslexia is on a continuum, will we be able to address some of those needs for children with dyslexia in the process? We absolutely will. And we'll be able to prevent them falling through the cracks long term. So that child could look like you or me. That child could live in any corner of the country. It could be rural. It could be an urban setting. It should not be a lottery for a child to be in a classroom with a teacher who understands the science of reading and how to explicitly teach the structure of the language. That is the equity piece here. And also when we think about children who even have access to certified teachers, it's shocking to me what I've seen nationally in some of the high poverty districts where just finding a certified teacher is so challenging. It's not like they're not trying to. So we need to even backload further to bringing honor to the profession by apprenticing teachers to be successful in the classroom, because it's foundational to apprenticing children in math and science and social studies. All of those are language based in some way or the other. And if teachers don't have that knowledge and understanding of how they are apprenticing their scholar in the literacy of their content area, we're missing an opportunity. The fastest improving systems, Susan, are those that focus on that capacity across the content areas, regardless of what content is being delivered.
That's powerful. That's powerful.
It's a game changer. It is.
And what does that mean in this COVID moment that we're in right now, right? How do you see things similar, different in either how students, what they're coming with or how we need to respond to them?
Yes. So the degree or the ability to respond to the pressures that COVID has placed on systems nationwide have been quite variable. And let's be clear, there are children who did not get a year and maybe have missed up to 2 years of instruction. So the Matthew effect is even more egregious for those scholars. And so as we think about, let's say, a fourth grader who never really learned the structure of the English language and may have missed up to a year and a half to 2 years of instruction, where are they in terms of their journey and being prepared for a knowledge economy? COVID has, I think, outlined the white elephant in the front room in multicolor. And the only reason we can't see it is we choose not to see it. And so I really have...
Tell me more about that.
Yes. We need to recognize this is a moment to identify the barriers to learning for children that start with good, solid first instruction and intervention, but also other barriers to learning that are exacerbated for children of poverty. How is it possible that within one district, I think of one district in my own backyard, that one school has a library and one school doesn't have a library. One school is tricked out with technology and another one isn't. And it's really based upon class. It's not just race, but when the two intersect, it becomes a huge challenge. So I think of literacy as a form of privilege. My ability to advocate for my children and to navigate systems would be different than somebody who has not had the exposure and the experiences I've had. But do we want to leave that to chance? We need to be able to embrace, in my opinion, the entire family unit, which is the nature of our work as a nonprofit, whether that parent wants to improve their literacy skills for their own personal development and for the growth and trajectory of their child. That's the right work to do in every neighborhood across this country. If we are going to be clear that in a knowledge economy, that is what changes the game.
And we are in a moment now where for the districts that you're helping advise or the state levels that you're helping advise, where we have an influx of resources in sort of a once in a lifetime moment.
Yes.
to look and make some significant changes. How are you thinking about that?
Well, what I'm hoping and thinking about and talking with leaders who are really ready to have honest conversation and discourse is to help them. It takes a degree of humility to admit that what I've been trying doesn't work and I own it. And on my watch, it's got to change. And so it takes shoulder partners who are going to be honest with you about what real change needs to take place for something different to happen. We can't do the same things. We can't push new things into old systems and expect it to work. It just doesn't work. So where are the proof points that I can learn from? How do I prep my system for change? And that has to do with also determining what to strategically abandon. What am I doing that's just wishful thinking or even malpractice, frankly? How is my system potentially teaching my scholars what struggling readers do as the way to teach reading to kids? I just have to be really authentic and real. That's what's happening in some systems. And so we can't do better until we know better. So educating ourselves about the practices that are proven, examining the system to see if that's happening or not, disengaging from what is actually harming scholars and educators, by the way, who want to do the right thing but aren't getting the right information, and then planning in a way that's multi-year, multi-phase, no band-aids. And it should be in board policy because superintendents come and go. But if it's in board policy, then it's an expectation of the board that it remain in place and that it be sustained. So those are the tough conversations we have to be willing to have in an unsiloed way to align our resources, align our people, really focus our time strategically, and then do these checkpoints along the way where we're seeing how's it going. Because if I get in my car and I put my hands on the steering wheel and I push the accelerator, but I don't adjust, I'm going to end up in a really bad way. But if I intentionally, right, as a leader, say, I know we're going to have to build in for mid-course adjustments. And again, have that shoulder partner who's going to tell you what you need to hear, not what you want to hear. If you're not uncomfortable, you're probably not doing the right work.
You know, when we were chatting before we got on this recording, you were talking to me a bit about this this metaphor that you use for this moment, and you called it the COVID chrysalis.
Yeah.
Can you talk to our listeners just a little bit about what that is? And it's so powerful.
Absolutely. So at the top of the pandemic, I was challenged in my thinking about what do we do because we can't deliver services face-to-face anymore. Our mission is reading success for all. We have stakeholders who are depending on us. So do we just sort of nail ourselves in a COVID coffin or decide we're going to go into a COVID chrysalis? I mean, it's either start living or don't. And we were going to continue to move forward. That's pretty brutal, glaring language, but I just have to say it was pretty straightforward. We can go into this chrysalis and we can define this moment as something that where we take our power back and we determine how we're going to move forward, or we just give up the ghost, if you will. And we decided when I challenged my team with that we were going to press on. And my team took our curriculum and they redesigned it so that we could deliver it virtually. They came up with the coaching model that would support that for sustainability for teachers in implementing the work with fidelity. And it's so stunning to me what has happened in the midst of this most challenging moment to put us in a position to do even more work to a greater scale than we have ever been able to before. NYHOUSE has been around for 40 years. And so there's this crossroads moment when COVID hit. We were just over the threshold of our 40th anniversary. Yeah. And I just think it's so interesting that at that crossroads, we were challenged to rethink and reinvent ourselves. And I think it's the same moment for us as a country, for districts, for state departments. How do we take this moment, reinvent ourselves, and come up with a new social contract that we forge with parents, not due to, but forge with them? What is the social contract that we want to agree to that says when your scholar leaves our system, they will be workforce ready and they will be ready for life because they have the literacy skills to help them adapt to those jobs that we don't even know exist, like you said, Susan, earlier. What I'm sure of is that they will need to be literate to access what's coming the novel opportunities that await us. And if we get that right, the future is bright for us.
Thank you. Thanks so much for sharing that, because I really do feel like you are right about us looking at this moment as a way for us to rethink, reinvent, and really, from my point of view, make progress in allowing all students to learn how to read, to give them access and to their future, right?
It's so high stakes, Susan. When we think about in our country, on average, 50% of prison inmates are dyslexic. That's an irrefutable dynamic we cannot ignore. How the school to prison pipeline is paved by a ton of good intentions, but they've got to be the intentions that are lined up to what works. And then we look at pre-adjudicated youth. Around 85% are functionally illiterate. And so those behaviors that we see are often grounded in a very shame-based experience in school. So I'd rather be the class clown and get some kind of attention than feel stupid and sit there day after day doing what isn't working for me. And I learned when I was leading work in one of the seventh largest district in this country, that at times our kids aren't waiting until high school to drop out. They are giving up in middle school. And so, what is a kid like that going to do long-term to have quality of life? One of the things that really is heartbreaking for us, with our adult literacy students, we have different advocates and allies. And one is actually a physician. And he talked about how he wanted to get involved in the work because he had functionally illiterate parents who would inadvertently overdose their kid because they couldn't read. And they were making their best guess about what dosage to give their kiddo. And that child is no longer with us today because the parent didn't know. They didn't know. And so all aspects from health to education to workforce, literacy underscores all of that. Reading a contract, doing your taxes, even applying for unemployment, applying for a driver's license. I mean, we've got to be literate to navigate those real life dynamics. Very high stakes.
Yeah, those are really powerful examples. And I appreciate you bringing them to us. I also appreciate the work that you're doing there at Nye House and your willingness to really share your experiences and motivate us all or reframe us all in terms of this important work. As we sort of come full circle here and talk about the work moving forward, what kind of advice would you give to leadership? I'm going to put it at the leadership level. What advice would you give them in terms of this important work?
The first piece of advice would be stay true to your values, your core values, your why, and why you started this journey as an educator. Don't let anybody get you off track. Stay true to your core values. That is your anchor in the storms during times where politics are trying to deter you from doing what's best for children, when ego-driven adult behavior can be a real distraction or challenge. Stay true to your core values and know who you are as a leader. Secondly, it's okay to admit what you don't know. So admit that with someone who can actually help you and who is genuinely there to center you in the right work. One of my favorite superintendents I've ever worked with said that great ideas live or die on the principal's desk, but I would add on the superintendent's desk. And so make sure that it is the right idea, and then do the brave, bold work of letting data-driven information shape your decision-making, and not just the hard data, also the qualitative data that tells you about the perception gap between what kids are saying. Survey your kids, see what they say about instruction and their experience in your system, teachers, leaders, et cetera. And then work on closing those perception gaps while you're addressing those quantitative dynamics, the formative assessments and what they're telling you. We need to look at triangulating all that data to shape what you do next. And there is no silver bullet. There is no Band-Aid. It's got to be multi-year, multi-tiered work that creates a literacy safety net that will not allow any child to fall through the cracks on your watch. And it's hard work. I get tired. I get weary. I will admit it. But I see successes that give me that spark to jump out of bed again and just keep moving forward. And when I see systems that are doing this work and they're sustaining it, it gives me so much joy. And when I see those children excited and jumping up and down in their seats, and they know they've got the right information to prepare them for success, then I know I'm doing what my mother and my father reared me to do. And that is be a servant leader. And being a leader is about disposition, not position. It's not the title. If you're a great teacher in your classroom and you're doing this work with fidelity, you're a leader. People are going to watch you, want to know why you're doing what you're doing, and you are an influencer. So let's all influence in a role-specific way and view yourself as a leader, not dependent upon title, but dependent upon your moral fabric as a human being, wanting to do the right thing for anyone within your realm of influence.
That is great advice. And I just want to say thank you for the leadership you've brought here, for the influence that just in this little bit of time, as well as the motivation. And I hope that you tell, since you're there with your mom, you tell your mom thank you from all of us for the influence she was on you to help influence the outcomes of others. So thank you again, Dr. Whedon, so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Susan. I will definitely pass that along. It'll make her smile.
Thank you so much for listening, and keep your feedback coming. Want to learn more? Be sure to stay connected by subscribing to your favorite podcast app and join our Facebook discussion group, Science of Reading the Community. And visit amplify.com to check out our brand new resource site offering all the tools and tips you need to continue on your Science of Reading journey. Until next time, keep the hope, take the action, and stay in touch. Let's get our kids to love reading.